we sit in Tarrant County, downtown Fort Worth, but we do like to get out, especially to universities whenever we get a chance, and present oral argument and have a Q&A session, not about the merits of the cases that we'll hear, obviously, but just about what we do in general. And the lawyers, as I understand it, have been kind enough to agree to stick around for the afternoon so that maybe they can give some insights too when we're all said and done. So I understand that all the lawyers have checked in. And before we get started, I'll introduce the panel that we have today. To my left is Justice Mike Wallach. To my right is Justice Wade Birdwell. And I'm Elizabeth Kerr. So with that, I will ask the clerk to call the case.
The court will now call Akeem Olajuwon Shaw versus the State of Texas. May it please the court. Mr. Kerry Jensen will argue for the appellant. Mr. Bryce Perry will argue for the state.
Mr. Jensen, may proceed.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. This is a criminal case involving an appeal of one count of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, Shaw versus State. Two counts of third degree deadly. Now, after the finding of the control enhancement is found true, jury assessed the punishment of 25, 5, and 2 years, respectively. Does the court need me to go over the factual history of the case or any questions?
If you want to give just a little bit of background, that would be great.
Okay.
That's your argument.
The victim in this case was Mr. Jones. He had heard that Mr. Shaw, the appellant, was having an affair with someone. So they agreed to meet up and basically just kind of fight it. Shaw showed up at this place, which was near his home, and a car pulled up behind him, and a man got out and shot at him. He dived into the car and kept shooting. Mr. Jones's neighbor and brother was yelling, please stop, and the shooter got in the car.
Now, these gentlemen had a history, right? They knew each other?
They did know each other.
Okay. And they had actually met before out on this road to settle some previous difference?
I'm not sure about that, Your Honor. I inherited this case from another attorney, so I'm not quite as well versed in the facts as I would have been if I had a rough break. So when Mr. Jones was taken to the hospital and he underwent several surgeries and wasn't able to talk to him. So Detective Cervantes was assigned to the case and found that there was a surveillance video from a nearby resident. So he was able to get a copy. She was able to get a copy of that video and found that it was blurry and discolored. And so the issue during this case is whether or not this video was admissible in court, whether the trial court abused its discretion in admitting this video because it was so blurry and discolored that it was not an accurate depiction of what the man
did. So I understand, though, Mr. Jones was able to watch the video himself before trial and agreed that the discoloration is notwithstanding, that it showed what he recalled the events of the day in question?
He started out saying that, but he kind of backpedaled on it later, saying that it wasn't perfectly accurate because of the blurring and discoloration. The blurring and discoloration, there is case law, as the state pointed out, that just having a blurry video doesn't make it inadmissible. The issue in this case is the color, and the coloring is especially important in this case because when a police officer calls in a suspect on the run, what's the first thing he does? He says, it's a black male, red shirt, blue jeans, keep an eye. And color is very important. Color is very important to the accuracy of what's being seen. problem with this video is that the color was so off that you could not tell the skin tone of the defendant. And because you couldn't tell the skin tone of the defendant, it was very not accurate. It wasn't just, oh, well, this is, I know it was a greenhouse, but on the video it showed that it's orange. Or is this car purple or is this car green? Those are irrelevant. But what is relevant is the skin tone of the defendant and whether or not that there was an identification of him. Correct identification corroborate Jones' story. Because Jones was a multiple-time convicted felon. He was a drug dealer. He had violent felonies in his past. And in this case, the state knew that unless there was some kind of corroborating evidence to support his theory, the jury just wasn't going to believe him.
Well, and the corroboration doesn't have to corroborate every aspect of Mr. Jones' testimony. It can corroborate aspects of his testimony. And the key identification is Mr. Jones, the one who said that it was Mr. Shaw who shot him. And right. So this happened to be a videotape that was taken at or near the time that all of this occurred. The landmarks on the tape were the same as what were described by Mr. Jones. So there were aspects of Mr. Jones' testimony that were in fact being corroborated by this. And so the attack was on authentication, and well, because it wasn't perfect, it should not have been able to come in.
Well, I would say that it's not only not perfect, but it actively misrepresented the scene because the color of the skin tone was wrong. Now, I know it doesn't have to, you know, it could have corroborated some other aspects of that, but when a jury listens to this man, Jones, who is very much not a credible witness, and they think, well, if this describes this and this describes this, if what he described as far as the actions go is correct, then his identification must have been correct as well. But the fact is, Mr. Jones had every reason to lie about the identification of the defendant because he thought that this man was sleeping with his girlfriend. So if he didn't know who shot him, he could have easily just thrown out. Shaw did it.
Didn't Mr. Jones pick Mr. Shaw's picture out of a photo lineup that was shown to him while he was still in the hospital?
Well, of course he did. He knows who Shaw is. I mean, if you're shown a picture of six people and you know one of them, you're going to be more likely to pick that one person.
So if he knows who his assailant is and he identifies the videos being accurate, why is that not sufficient basis to make it at least admissible, the rest of it going to the weight which the jury considered?
Because it went so far as to be misleading. That's
in what way?
In that the color of the shooter's skin was not accurately represented in the video.
Well, I thought the trial testimony turned more on the color of the car, which had a distinctive paint job, I take it, some sort of like shimmery sort of teal green that looked different colors and different lights. I confess I haven't read every word of the court record, but my recollection was that instead of the skin tone discrepancies, arguably, that it was more about the car.
Well, the defendant specifically argued at closing that the skin tone wasn't the issue. And it was at issue in this case.
Well, it's undisputed, though, that everybody, both the state and the defense, agreed that they could not tell based on the video who this individual was. There were no facial characteristics that were identifying one way or the other. Right? And that this coloration is just such that you wouldn't necessarily know that this was actually part of the video. It was arguing more about the car. But you wouldn't know what color shirt the assailant was wearing, what kind of pants or anything of that nature. But it wasn't offered for that purpose. It was offered as an authentic representation of the interaction that in fact occurred and where it occurred, which in fact corroborated Mr. Jones' testimony as to where it occurred
It was so blurry and so discolored that you couldn't even tell what was going on. Then how could it be an accurate representation of what it purported to be?
Well, there was a tree across the street that accurately portrayed where that tree was at the time. There were other aspects of the landscape that were accurately portrayed. So it was accurate with regard to certain aspects of the scene itself and where it occurred. Okay. So the fact that it was discolored had nothing to do with whether or not that was the same tree or not. Okay, that was my point. Is so at what point in time does a video that is accurate with regard to some things become so inaccurate that it can be authenticated and even be considered for admissibility under other situations?
Because there were just quite a few different things that stacked up to make it inauthentic. First of all, every single person that saw the video testified to it and said that it was inaccurate, that it didn't have a correct coloration, that it was blurry. Every single one. And on top of that, the person that took the video, the person that had the security camera, did not show up at trial to testify to what it was recorded on, how accurate it was,
Hadn't the homeowner passed away at the time of the trial?
Right.
Do you agree that this is an abuse of discretion standard of review?
I do agree that it's an abuse of discretion standard review. However, I do think that this is an abuse of discretion. The abuse of discretion, this is outside the zone of reasonable disagreement. The facts supplied are not sufficient to support a reasonable jury determination that it's applicable. Cervantes testified that the video depicted areas she knew and she agreed that colors were wrong. Laughlin could not say the skin tone of the video was an accurate representation of the color of the video. Everything was off. Cervantes flat out said it was wrong, quote, wrong. Jones originally made an accurate depiction, but later concluded he didn't know if it was accurate or not. And like I said, Jones had every motive to lie in this case. Sanders said his house was green, but the video showed that it was orange. There was the color of the car was different. And just every eyewitness, when questioned about the authenticity of the video, said it was not accurate.
Well, let's assume that the surveillance video was in black and white. And you take a step further and say that it was one of those reverse negative sort of black and whites. Would you still be here appealing this conviction because that video was inaccurate?
Well, because of my client's constitutional right to appeal a conviction, I'd be here no matter what. But the black and white is a little different because it does show how light or dark someone's skin is. That's the main issue here, is that it was the only thing that could corroborate a drug-addicted, violent felon's testimony.
What, didn't Mr. Jensen's brother... Mr. Jensen, the victim's brother.
Jones. Okay, yes.
Yeah, Mr. Sanders, I think was his name.
Yes.
Did he testify that the girlfriend that was being fought over, that he heard, because he was at the scene, didn't he testify that he heard her say the name of your client, the first name?
Something like it, but the girlfriend didn't testify on her own behalf as well. And also, even though he was two doors down, he could not identify the shooter. The police did not even show him a police lineup because he said he wouldn't be able to pick the person out.
Let me turn. How much time?
It's a minute and a half.
Turn one again. I'm back to this authentication. It may be accurate for other reasons. It actually shows, the testimony, for example, Jones testified that he got out of the car when he saw this other car pull up behind him. Okay? So the video accurately record shows that Jones did in fact get out of the car, that when after this car pulled up, and then whoever it was, okay, the jury found your client, but whoever it was got out of the car and pulled up behind him and started firing and caused Mr. Jones to get into back into the car, then that individual came up to the car and continued to shoot into the car. All of that is what Mr. Jones testified to. The video shows every bit of that. The fact that there, you can't tell who is doing what, but it accurately shows what in fact occurred. Why is that not sufficient to authenticate the tape and then leave the issue of identification for the jury and credit Mr. Jones' credibility for that matter in terms of his identification to the jury with regard to the waste of it?
I'm about to be out of time. May I answer the question? The issue again is, you know, it's not an accurate depiction of what happened that evening because it was very blurry. It was discolored. It was more than just a blurry video. It was blurry video and it was discolored. And it just wasn't, it wasn't right. I mean, the investigating officer specifically said it looked wrong.
As far as the coloration, but not necessarily the movement of things and people on the video.
Right. But it's still just such a, you know, the state, just real quick about harm, you know, the state mentioned this video to every single person in there. I mean, they really did not have a case without this video.
Thank you very much. You add 30 seconds to the state's time, please. Mr. Perry, whenever you're ready.
the appellant King Shaw in the video.
I noticed that representation was in the state's brief. I looked at those pages of the record and I didn't see that there was an exact Q&A where Mr. Jones said, yes, that is Shaw on the video.
So starting on the page, if I made that misrepresentation, I apologize. But starting on page 107 of the record, he's asked, have you viewed the video file that's on this disc? And he answered, yes, sir. And then he's asked, and I'm sure it was hard to watch, hard to read, but he said, yes, sir. Do the contents of this video depict what you saw and what you experienced that day? Yes, sir. He had already previously testified that it was King Shaw who committed this offense against him. So when he's answering, do the contents of this video depict what you saw and what you experienced that day, I think he's incorporating that testimony and he's saying he's seeing King Shaw on that video. So that's the state's response to that. The video that's in dispute here is state's exhibit 14.
But he never actually says that to the jury. He never actually says that to the judge. That in fact, I recognize Mr. Shaw on that video. I understand your incorporation of argument, but he never actually testifies that I see Mr. Shaw on that video.
I'm not sure that I find that as I'm looking at his testimony, although he does say on page 109, he's asked, okay, Mr. Jones, back to the video, would you describe the stature? Is the defendant a short man? He says, yes, sir. And then he's asked, generally a pretty short guy. He says, yes. And then he's asked, can you, would you say that you can see that in the video in relation to, and he says, of course. So he's asked about the stature of the defendant. He says the defendant is short.
He's asking about the stature of somebody that's referred to as he, right?
I guess I'm not
following. I guess where I'm having a little bit of a problem, and I get your inference argument and in the gestalt of things, but I don't recall seeing that Mr. Jones said, yes, I see the defendant. He is short. That's him.
Yeah, in my Your Honor, I guess I don't see that explicitly in his testimony as either, but I think when he's testifying about, he had previously testified before this exchange that King Shaw was the one who did the shooting. He had also previously testified that King Shaw was short. And so when he reaches this point in his testimony, he's asked, is the defendant a short man? And then he's asked, would you say you can see that in the video? I think the implication from that is he's saying, I see that particular short man, King Shaw, as I'm watching this video.
Well, there's a distinction between saying, I recognize him in the video, and saying, I don't recognize him in the video, but I know that was him because I was there and I saw him do what he did, and the video accurately represents what he did.
Well, I think there is a distinction between those two things, but I think he did both, Your Honor. I think he said, before this exchange, I think he said, I know that man, and he's the man that committed the offense. And then in this exchange, when he's asked, can you see, is the defendant a pretty short guy, and then would you say you can see that in the video, in other words, can see that short guy in the video. He's saying both of those things in the state's viewing of the record. So, with respect to that authentication issue, the video is State's Exhibit 14-1, and if the court hasn't had a chance to view it yet, I would just direct the court's attention to the 1 hour and 3 minute mark of that video. I'm not sure why an hour of kind of irrelevant part of the video was put in, but the 1 hour and 3 minute mark of that video shows a sports car driving into the scene in the video, and a white SUV driving into the same scene. A man gets out of the white SUV with a gun and sort of walks around the scene, and he walks towards the dark SUV and points his gun and shoots at the SUV, then walks around the scene for a little bit longer, shoots again, and gets in the white SUV and drives away. And there's been an issue raised
by... You're describing colors of things in the video.
Yes.
You're describing things as you see those colors in the video, but your testimony is pretty clear that the coloration is off, correct?
Your Honor, it's clear that the colors were jaded, and the state's witnesses acknowledged that in their testimony. The colors weren't perfect. But the color's being jaded. It's not necessarily being tones were jaded.
No,
I think that's one of the...
But didn't Mr. Jones also agree that his car, the Dodge Charger in the video, that the color of his car was accurately represented when in the video it looked like purple, and it's actually in real life teal green? So was Mr. Jones mistaken?
He provided testimony in that regard that was inconsistent with the testimony that the police officers, Marissa Cervantes and John Laughlin, provided with respect to the colors of the video. So I think with respect to that, the trial court and its gatekeeping function, and as the case law describes it, the low bar of gatekeeping to allow the video to be held as authentic and be admitted, could resolve that conflict in the testimony and rely on the testimony of the police officers, and on that particular point, disregard the testimony of the victim.
So you're taking position that it really goes to weight and credibility, not admissibility in the first place, whether the jury should have ever seen the video.
That's the state's position. That's the way the case law described it as well, that the ultimate arbiter of whether the video is authentic or inauthentic is the fact finder, in this case the jury. And so the jury gets to make that ultimate decision. The trial court's role is simply allowing under Rule of Evidence 901 evidence to come in if it could support a rational finding by the ultimate fact finder, in this case the jury, that evidence is authentic. And for all the reasons in the state's brief, including the direct authentication of Jones, the victim, saying that's me in the video and recognizing the cars in the video, and then the circumstantial authentication of the police officers who said there's trees that I see, there are houses that I see across the street, the date stamp being accurate in the video. Officer Cervantes testified in her testimony that what she had seen in the video matched up with what eyewitnesses to the offense, including Mr. Jones and Mr. Sanders, had said had occurred.
But what is in question, if that's the color of the skin and the color of the car, whether there's a tree present at a particular location or a shoe on the ground at a different location, what is the, number one, the trial court's supposed to make its decision on in terms of accuracy to determine its admissibility, and then how are we supposed to gauge that decision and looking at it under an abuse of discretion?
So I think there's a couple of responses that I have to that question. And the first one is that the colors, as I mentioned, they were acknowledged by the state's witnesses, at least the officers, as being off. But the reason that, there's a couple of reasons why that doesn't defeat authentication. And the first one is that while the colors were off, tones were not. And if the court watches the video, the court will see that...
What do you mean by the tones were not?
Okay, so, for example, in Officer Cervantes' testimony, she was asked on volume 4, page 6 of the reporter's record, do you see a white SUV enter the frame of the video? And she testified, yes. That was a critical fact because the defendant's car was a white SUV. Later in the trial, the defendant's girlfriend at that time, Connie Thornton, testified on volume 5, page 59 of the record, that she recognized that white SUV as her car. She told the state's investigator that, although she provided a different testimony at trial, the state's investigator's testimony at trial was that when he met with her before trial, she said, I watched the video, that's my car. So even though there was a green tint to the video and it distorted some of the colors in the video, as acknowledged by the state's witnesses, it didn't distort tones in a way that rendered it completely unhelpful in identifying those things.
Let me interrupt you here. Pardon me, but if we're looking at an abuse of discretion standard, and the trial court is responsible for taking conflicting or different pieces of information from different people and deciding whether this video actually represents what it's supposed to depict, isn't that the function of the trial court, which we're not supposed to second guess under an abuse of discretion standard?
Yes, Your Honor. That's...
So how, and so the next question is, how off does it have to be before we can say that the trial court abused his discretion in making that determination.
So, Your Honor, I think the question of how far off the video has to be would have to be decided on a case-by-case basis depending on the evidence of the witnesses who are testifying about the contents of the video. If you have, such as in this case or in other kinds of cases, someone who was there on the scene at the time who says, I was there that day, I recognize the things that are in the video, that's what happened to me, then I think there can be distortions in terms of the video being blurry or being discolored, or except in the Clemson versus State case, the state cites in its brief, there was a broken head and it made the video fuzzy, and this court held in that case that it did not defeat authentication just because the video was fuzzy. So if you have that kind of testimony of someone who was there at the time and says, that's what happened to me, then the matter of discoloration or fuzziness or maybe garbled audio or any of those kind of things could affect the jury's weight that it gives the recording, but would not affect admissibility. If you have a different kind of case where there's no eyewitness there who testifies in terms of I was there at the scene and I can recognize and tell you this is exactly what happened to me, and if the case concerned disputed fact matters in which the colors were critical to deciding of guilt or innocence, I think there could be a case where an abuse of discretion could be shown in that case, but that's not the circumstance here.
So let's assume that you had a video with perfect coloration and it matches what presumably we all, with our common eyes, would see as particular colors, and you had a critical witness who was colorblind. Would they be able to authenticate a video?
I think that's an interesting question. So I think I would have to think about that before I give you a good answer to that question. The video, your question, the video is accurate, but the witness is not, because the witness I had a son who's colorblind, so that's what's interesting about the question to me. I think in that case, is the witness an eyewitness to the offense who can say, I was there at that time, that's what I experienced? If so, then the color variation, I don't think, affects admissibility of that video, because the witness can still say, this is something I personally experienced, and I can affirm that's what happened to me at that spot on that.
So do you concede that this might be a different case? Obviously, it would be a different case. Let's say that Jones had been blinded in this incident, couldn't watch the video, and couldn't say, yes, this tracks what happened to me. I recognize this event because I was there. And would you say it would be a closer or a different outcome if we had only the detectives testifying about a video that they can see doesn't show colors correctly?
Your Honor, I don't think this case would be different. I think there could be some cases that might be, but this one wouldn't be, given the testimony of Officer Cervantes and Officer Hoffman. Given all the circumstances taken together by what they testified, it's not just that they recognize trees and houses, but it's the date stamp on the video, it's the fact that Officer Cervantes had spoken to the victim and spoken to Montreal Sanders, the eyewitness to the events, and that what she had learned from them matched up to what she had seen in the video, and all of the other testimony that they provided in this case would have been enough to circumstantially identify it, even if without the direct authentication of Jones' victim in this case. Just real quick, I would like to return to the issue of colors versus tint, because there's concession in the appellant's brief that I think is important to that issue. In his brief, he says on page 7, the video rendered the shooter as having a dark skin tone, similarly to what a black and white picture or video would. A black and white photo obviously provides different colors than a color photo would, but you can still tell the darkness or light of the nature of skin tones. And the concession that we've done is brief is that the video in this case did just that. Also,
there's an abusement of the term you use the word tint. I'm sorry, are you using tint interchangeably with tone?
Tint and tone, yes. I think I'm trying to use those interchangeably. There was also an argument by the appellant today that the homeowner's testimony, but the homeowner had died, he wasn't able to authenticate. But under the case law side in the state's brief, that's not required to authenticate the video. What's required is either a direct mode of authentication, which Jones provided, or a circumstantial mode of authentication which the officer provided. And so I think for all of those reasons, there's direct authentication here through the victim's testimony. There's circumstantial identification through the officer's testimony. There's a broad amount of discretion from the trial court as the gatekeeper in admitting the video. And putting all of those things together, there's no use of discretion in the admitting of the video. But if the court disagrees,
the officer can't testify and didn't testify that the video accurately represented the activities involved itself. Only Jones was the only one who could authenticate that the activity portrayed by the video was accurately reflected. The officers could only say this is the same exact place. Appears to be the same car, that type of thing, SUV, because they've seen the SUV subsequent to that type of thing. But as far as the activity is concerned, and therefore the identification of the individual, that still relies solely on the identification provided by him.
Your Honor, that's true, but the Fowler case from the Court of Criminal Appeals in 2018 makes the distinction between a direct mode of authentication, which I think Your Honor is describing, and that's what Jones provided, and then circumstantial authentication, which would be the same as circumstantial evidence to prove guilt. Putting certain circumstances together of a comparison is walking outside and seeing a gray sky and seeing water on the ground, having a smell of rain, but never having seen it rain, and coming to the conclusion that it rained, even though you didn't see it rain. And putting all of the circumstances together that the officers knew and testified about, their testimony is sufficient to circumstantially authenticate it even without Jones' direct authentication to the video. On the issue of harm, before my time expires, there's a couple of concessions that were made this afternoon that I think are important. The appellant said that these men knew each other, and that's what the record bears out. As I mentioned, these were two men who had met at a previous dispute at the same location in Wichita Falls in the past, and there's simply no indication in the record whatsoever that anyone else would have had a motive to commit the offense of shooting Jones on the day that this offense occurred. There was also a concession, he knows who shot it. I think that's an important concession with respect to the harm analysis. And counsel also said that the video was blurry and unhelpful. If that's the position of the appellant, then its blurry and unhelpful nature would also render it harmless. If the video didn't push the jury over the goal line and decide the issue of the appellant's guilt because it was blurry and unhelpful, then it couldn't have been harmful to the jury's consideration of his guilt either. So I think for all of those reasons, the court should hold that the trial court did not abuse its discretion by admitting the video. It was directly authenticated and circumstantially authenticated. The trial court had a large breadth of discretion as a gatekeeper in admitting it. And even if there was an abuse of discretion, there's no harm revealed by the record given all the circumstances that the record shows. Unless the court has further questions. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. Please, the court, opposing counsel. As far as Mr. Perry's statement saying that there was no other alternative perpetrator theory presented, he seems to be confusing whose burden it is to prove that the defendant is guilty. You know, in his brief, he said that the Shaw did not put forward any other alternative theory in order to show that there was someone else out there devoted to do this. But that's not the defendant's job. It's the state's job to prove that there wasn't. So I don't think that's really a big contentious point right here. Bottom line again is that this video does not accurately represent what it purports to represent. I mean, how can the video be both accurate and inaccurate? All of the testimony said that it was inaccurate.
I'm sorry. It can be accurate to show that there's a tree over here and a tree. there, but yet inaccurate or imprecise with respect to facial features, skin color, and other matters, correct?
Right, but if it's accurate for some things but not accurate for another, then that becomes a confusing issue for the jury.
At what point?
At this point.
Well, and from a legal standpoint, is there some test that you can direct us to that says it is the particular issue question that determines the admissibility of the video if it's not precise on a particular point of issue, or is it the overall picture that comes into question that the court is called upon to admit the admissibility of?
Well, I agree with Mr. Perry that it is very much a case-by-case basis. But one thing that hasn't been mentioned yet is that the jury asked to see the video again. And I think that any of us could infer that they were confused by that video. They had to look at it more carefully because on a first glance, they couldn't really understand what was going on.
I'm trying to wrap my head around the concept of inaccuracy within the facts of this case. I can see a different situation if it was hotly contested whose car it was, and the defendant had a yellow car, and the video didn't show that it was a yellow car. It showed that it was a blue car. Then I can see where you can say that it is potentially inaccurate on a critical fact for the jury to consider. Or you can say that the video would certainly be inaccurate if it looks like what we have, but suddenly one of the cars, you know, starts levitating above the ground. You could go, well, that's an inaccurate video because that doesn't happen.
And I understand where you're going with that, but that would go more towards harm than admissibility. If you look at the Johnson versus State case, the defendant briefed, this is the one with the aggravated sexual assault of a child, and the child asked if it was an accurate depiction of what he said, and the child said, not exactly. And the trial court was overruled for admitting that evidence because...
Well, a little bit further than that, she categorically said it doesn't accurately represent certain things. She categorically denied that the interview that was being offered was something that she remembered actually giving at certain points. And so the courtroom appeals at that point and said, well, she's not going to sponsor the video as a completely accurate thing. And there's nothing in that opinion that talks about whether or not it was then offered for only portions of it that she could support one way or the other. It was an all or nothing situation. So here you have a sponsoring witness with Martha Jones testifying that accurately represents everything. And there's no, it, let me switch that argument. Had in fact he had given an interview at the hospital and said he never got out of the car, then y'all would be wanting to say it's authentic because the video shows him getting out of the car, and you're able then to impeach his testimony in the circumstances. So and in that situation, it doesn't matter what the tone or tint of the actual video is. It's showing something either accurately or inaccurately as it happened.
You can wrap up in about 10 seconds.
Just 10 seconds.
Well, Mr. Jones even said in his testimony that, you know, it would aid the jury. So not only does that go towards harm, but it also goes to the fact that he's admitting, I don't believe this. And, you know, the trial court does have a gatekeeping function. So you can't just say that every single evidentiary ruling is based solely on this admissibility standard because the judge has to weigh the credibility as well.
Thank you very much. So, gentlemen, appreciate the oral argument. Your case is submitted. I know that the schedule says that our next argument will be at 2:45, but since we don't have council change or anything, would anybody object to starting it at 2:30? Would that create any problems with things like scheduling? Okay. Then we will stand.